Beer and high tech on the program today. Yes, in the same story. The return of the humble television antenna and what Al Gore has been doing since, you know, since that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, today I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us, everybody, on this Tuesday. It is the 13th day of October, day two of a week that is shaping up to be quite the entry in the mergers and acquisitions record books. Yesterday, it was Tech Dell finalizing its $67 billion takeover of EMC, the data storage company. Today, it was Beer, Anheuser-Busch InBev offering a hair more than $100 billion for SAB Miller. That brings the global M&A total this year to $3.5 trillion with a T dollars, the highest year-to-date tally since Thomson Reuters began tracking this stuff back in 1980. It's a story of corporate growth, really, and the challenges there, too. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains without falling back on any of those tired relationship metaphors M&A stories often use. Yes, Tracy?
No comparisons to dating, marriage, or hookups, I promise. Just the facts. Lots of deals across lots of industries.
Royal Dutch Shell and BG Group in the oil and gas sector. Charter Communications and Time Warner Cable in media. Dell and EMC this week in tech.
Matthew Toole is the director of deals intelligence at Thomson Reuters. He can go on like this for a long time.
Ace and Chubb in life insurance.
Do you have a list you're reading off of, or are you doing this on the top of your head?
I do.
That list, more than 32,000 deals so far this year. Toole says part of it is pent-up demand coming out of the financial crisis. Companies feel confident enough to spend money, take risks. Plus, revenue growth has been sluggish, says Richard Peterson. He's with S&P Capital IQ.
Companies sometimes look to a so-called acquired growth by buying other companies. If you can't grow organically on your own, you look to buy growth elsewhere.
M&As can help companies get into new markets, for example. And if everyone else is pairing off, strictly in the corporate sense, of course, that creates pressure.
Essentially, we're getting bigger and bigger companies that need global proportions to survive and prosper.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Law.
In a number of markets, you're going from four players to three, possibly three players to two, and companies are trying to get dominant positions in the market before they themselves are acquired.
But Solomon says M&As move in cycles, so this flurry won't last forever. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Hot on the heels of yesterday's economics Nobel going to a guy who studies poverty, Credit Suisse released its annual wealth report today. The top 1% of humanity now owns half of all the household wealth on the planet, and increasingly, that wealth is coming from stocks and bonds, which means the 99% is getting left farther and farther behind. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
The report says during the housing bubble, investments in things like real estate did better than stocks and bonds. Then the bubble burst, the financial crisis began, and stocks took a tumble, but they're back and are now a bigger slice of global wealth. Unfortunately, in the U.S.,
half the public doesn't own stock at all.
That's Dorothy Brown, a law professor at Emory University. She says even fewer minorities own stocks.
I'd say about 1 in 10 people of color may own stock.
Which leads to an inescapable conclusion. If the richest people in the world get more of their wealth from financial assets like stocks and bonds, the wealth gap gets even wider. And consider this, 60 to 70% of people in poorer countries have no net assets, according to Branko Milanovic, an economist at City University of New York.
If the financial assets do really well, then surely the gap between those who are at the very top and those who are in the middle goes up.
But don't forget, stocks go up and down. Gene Sturley is an economist and fellow at the Urban Institute. He says if the stock market tanks, it'll narrow the wealth gap.
At a point in time, it definitely will. Just as when the stocks went up relative to real estate or other types of assets, it increased the wealth gap.
And the Credit Suisse report says if the stock market just goes up more slowly, wealth inequality may rise more slowly, too. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of the stock market, maybe it was something they ate. I don't know, but traders ran out of steam after lunch today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. as in we, the television-watching public in America, have been ditching our cable boxes for a good couple of years now. Cable companies are, of course, keeping a wary eye on that, but the rise of the cord cutters has been very good news for a different part of the television industrial complex, the people who sell good old-fashioned over-the-air TV antennas. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan has that one.
When 25-year-old Jordan Bishop moved into his apartment near the University of Wyoming in Laramie, the idea of signing up for cable never even crossed his mind. Way too expensive. Instead, he got an Apple TV so he can Netflix his favorite shows.
30 Rock, old 30 Rock episodes. Louie is always a great one.
Rent and stream movies.
They Came Together, Book of Eli.
You get the picture. But today is Sunday, football day.
So you look at a third down and six.
The game's playing on network TV, and it looks great, crystal clear. For that, Bishop can thank a different product, his over-the-air TV antenna. He bought it for $50, and that's all he paid, plus the cost to mount the thing.
It's up taped up on my wall.
Is that it?
Yeah, it just hooks right back into the TV. It's just like a little flat box that sits up.
Okay, so they're not all the rabbit ears you might remember, but TV antennas are back. The number of homes in the U.S. that take network TV over the air and don't use cable or satellite has gone up by about 17% since 2010, according to Nielsen data. That's been a surprise to Jim Petty, who works as a volunteer to maintain the TV broadcast infrastructure in the Laramie area. He says back in the mid-2000s, he was ready to shut his operation down.
There was that whole air of inevitability out there. Hey, you know, it's all going to go to Wi-Fi or, you know, cable or satellite, and these things will be pointless, and let's just stop doing it right now.
But then free over-the-air TV got a facelift to digital.
ABC7 wants you ready for the digital evolution. Digital quality is far better. So starting February 17th, 2009, all broadcast TV has to be digital by law.
As more and more viewers have realized that you can catch the game on broadcast TV for free and it looks just as good as cable, Petty's hearing from them. That, combined with the cord-cutting phenomenon, means big business for the TV antenna industry.
Initially, my goal was to sell about 35 antennas a month.
Richard Schneider runs a company called Antennas Direct, based in the St. Louis suburbs.
I think last month we shipped about a little over 70,000 antennas.
Schneider says Antennas Direct sales went from $13 million in 2013 to $20 million last year. The company's biggest problem now, he says, is reaching all the people who don't realize broadcast TV is still around.
Right now, we're only selling to, you know, the minority that knows that over-the-air even exists. People we talk to aren't even aware that you can get digital TV for free.
And those people may be more likely to download a new app on their smart TV than go out and buy an antenna. Michael Goodman is with Strategy Analytics, a tech research firm.
I think the biggest challenge is broadcast networks wanting to go to consumers direct.
Just like many other media companies, broadcast networks are getting into the streaming game. And they have an incentive to lure you back to cable. Goodman says that's because broadcast networks make a lot of money from carriage fees. The $1.50 or so they get from each cable subscriber who has the network as part of a package. Broadcast networks don't get carriage fees if you watch them with an antenna.
We're in a transition period right now where people are looking for more and more options to cut the cord. But I think all of those networks are going to look to shift those costs onto the consumer in a different way.
So it's not clear where the TV antenna industry is headed next, but right now it's hot, though you still might need to buy your own tape. In Laramie, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
This past weekend at New York Comic Con, there was a sold-out screening of the first episode of The X-Files. Yes, that X-Files, and no, not the very first episode from back in 1993. We're talking X-Files 2.0 here. Fox is bringing back the series this January to the delight of its loyal fans. And 13 years after it went off the air, there are still loyal X-Files fans because the show changed a whole lot about television as we then knew it. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the story.
Tom Noonan was an executive at Fox in 1993. At the time, Fox was the new kid on the block and looking to stand out. That's the mindset he and other execs had when they sat down in a screening room with Rupert Murdoch himself to watch the pilot episode of The X-Files.
I don't think anyone really knew at the time what the potential would be.
Do you believe in the existence of extraterrestrials?
Logically, I would have to say no.
When the pilot finished, Noonan says Murdoch turned to the executives and asked this question.
He said, how many of you are true believers? And the vast majority of the room raised their hands. They were so convinced by the pilot that we're not alone.
Talk about the power of TV. Noonan says The X-Files changed a lot about the business. He says it was the first dark drama about aliens and the paranormal, and it created its own mythology with story arcs that ran multiple episodes. Brian Lowry, TV critic at Variety, spent time in The X-Files writer's room. He argues that a lot of what happened was just serendipity.
I don't think they were actively trying to change anything. I mean, I think once the show was up and running, they had some latitude to play around with the format, and they were smart enough to know that their audience was with them and that they could do it.
The success of X-Files made room for other shows that emulated its style. Think Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Now, X-Files is returning to a far more crowded landscape, and the Fox network is more cautious. It's ordered a limited 6-episode run of the series reboot. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He felt as if, compared with other people in the Senate, he had never really made money. So for a couple of years, he did just that.
Al Gore, capitalist. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 0.2% today, about 49 points, closed at 17,081. The NASDAQ reversed itself 0.8%, 42 points, closed at 47.96. The S&P 500 let go of 0.2%. That works out to 13 points, 2003 there. Johnson & Johnson kicked off the day's earnings parade by reminding everybody what it looks like to get hammered by the strong dollar. Shares off 0.5% with AB InBev, that's Anheuser-Busch InBev, and SAB Miller finally ending their game of buy me if you can. Shares in both beer giants foamed up. Get it? Foamed up. InBev added 1.2% on the merger deal. SAB Miller brewed up a 9% gain. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the producer price index for September. Quite a while back, it was known as the wholesale price index. The Federal Reserve issues its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. And tomorrow is National Dessert Day. Be careful, a Google image search will make you hungry. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It has perhaps escaped your notice, and if it has, it's totally understandable. But central banks around the world have been selling off U.S. debt, government bonds, at quite the clip lately. Russia, Brazil, and especially China spent much of the past decade snapping up American treasuries. So why now the reversal? Marketplace's Andy Euler picks up the story from there.
Over the past 6 months or so, emerging economies, not least of which China, have seen money that was invested in them move elsewhere. In August, more than $140 billion left China. A lot of that has to do with the weakening yuan and the strengthened U.S. dollar. China selling our government treasury bonds isn't necessarily a reflection on the U.S. economy, more an effort to bolster its own currency.
Dumping U.S. government debt. That's not what the Chinese are doing.
Meg Lunsager used to be the executive director of the U.S. portion of the IMF. She's now a fellow at the Wilson Center. She says emerging market currencies have been under pressure.
So you've seen many other countries selling off some of their official foreign exchange reserve assets, which is going to be held in U.S. government securities, and using that to support their currency in the foreign exchange markets.
The People's Bank of China isn't trying to play the market, just soften the blow of all those dollars leaving China and slow down the depreciation of its currency.
That's what reserves are for.
Ted Truman is a fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics.
So it's actually a little surprising, if anything, it's a little surprising that official holdings of U.S. treasuries have not gone down more.
And that's an important distinction, official holdings. Those are the bonds that the central bank is selling. The latest Treasury data shows the central bank is unloading U.S. debt, but privately, the Chinese are still investing. Again, Meg Lunsager.
There's been private buying, so there's still been net buying of U.S. government securities.
She says it's important to remember that the Treasury market is a big one, almost $13 trillion, and to remember that a couple trillion are still being held by China. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You don't have to be a travel professional to know that if you book a vacation during the off-season, wherever you want to go, you're going to get a cheaper rate. It stands to reason, right? You may not know, however, that when you do that, you are using the same kinds of strategies as Wall Street investors who play in a particularly risky corner of finance. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has an investing lesson with the flavor of piña colada.
If you want an island getaway right now, you'll get a heck of a deal in the Atlantic and Caribbean because it's hurricane season. To see just what's available, I brought in a real expert.
All right, let's go to Paradise Island in the Bahamas.
That's Pauline Frommer of the travel guidebook series that bears her family name. It turns out even famous travel writers start like the rest of us, online. They also hate the same stuff we do.
Pop-up ad. Curse you.
She powers through the ads and shows us some fares.
5 nights with airfare from New York for $635. So a little over $100 a day. That's not bad.
And it's more than a third cheaper than the same trip in February. Popular travel site CheapCaribbean.com says hurricane season discounts can be as deep as 60%. Fares have to be low to entice people. And it works. Kate Grubel remembers the moment she took the bait.
So about 3 months ago, Southwest sent out one of their typical emails for, you know, $39.99 one way. And as I was looking through available dates on my end, I saw a really great deal for the Bahamas in October.
Just like that, she and her boyfriend had a beach vacation at a great price. They knew it was hurricane season, but the risk they were taking really hit home in early October.
Good morning, George. Hurricane Joaquin has been battering the central and eastern Bahamas for the
Bahamas got the worst of Joaquin, and suddenly the downside of Grubel's gamble was all over the news. And it's important to understand that's exactly what it was, a gamble. It's risky, and then it could have the high return of a great vacation on the cheap, or the low return of a hurricane ruining the whole trip, maybe worse. That's very similar to a shadowy corner of Wall Street called distressed assets. Santa Clara University finance professor So-Young Kim explains.
These are things that will come very cheap because there's a high likelihood that you could lose all of your money, but there's also that chance that you may hit a very huge payoff in the end.
Distressed investors bet on companies and countries in their worst moments. Right now, some of them are gambling on retailer American Apparel, which recently went bankrupt after a long nightmare of falling sales and drama involving its ousted founder. If the company turns around, they'll make a killing. If not, they'll lose just about everything they put in.
You have to ask someone, are you really okay with the downside?
Professional investors can hedge bets by investing in many different distressed assets, so a few big wins make up for all the losses. Vacationers booking during hurricane season can hedge their bets, too. Dan Durazzo is with insurance provider Allianz Global Assistance.
Generally, travel insurance will cost a traveler somewhere between 5 and 7% of their trip cost.
Travel experts like Frommer recommend shopping for insurance through comparison sites like Squaremouth and Insure My Trip. But just like on Wall Street, hedging has a cost. Whatever's spent on insurance eats up some of the money saved by booking during hurricane season. Now let's go back to Grubel and her own distressed investment in Bahamas Leisure. Hurricane Joaquin definitely brought out the doubters.
Yeah, no, everyone, all of our friends who knew we were going were sending us links and information and, you know, grateful that we weren't actually on the ground.
Fortunately, she and her boyfriend had booked dates after the storm blew through, leaving their hotel intact.
So I think it'll still be a good bet. You know, if things don't work out, we have many years to go back if we have to.
They knew the risk and rolled the dice. It's the same for a hedge fund billionaire betting on a bankrupt company or a young couple wagering the seas won't swamp their umbrella drinks. Don't try a risky bet unless you're cool with the consequences. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Al Gore, once the next president of the United States, then an Academy Award winner for the climate change film An Inconvenient Truth, also a Nobel Peace Prize winner for his environmental work, and now a guy who's found a way to make a lot of green by being green over the long term. James Fallows, most often heard on these airwaves in a different context, that of his small plane and our series American Futures, has a story in the November issue of The Atlantic magazine explaining just how Gore wants to save the planet and maybe kind of, sort of, along the way, change up capitalism at the same time. Jim, it's good to talk to you again.
Kai, nice to talk to you.
This is not, I think it's safe to say, the Al Gore that most of us remember.
That's true, and that's why I was so interested in hearing this story about the part of his life over the last dozen years that we don't know about. We know about the Nobel Prizes. We know about mm-hmm. the climate activism, but he's had this other chapter of his activity that he's now going public with.
It is called Generation Investment Management. Obviously, it's a management firm doing things a little bit differently.
Yes. They wanted to have a test case, which they've run now for more than a decade, of if you invested money, but also look for all the sustainability factors that Gore and others have stood for, of environmental effects, of effects on the civil society where companies are operating, about governance and transparency of the companies themselves. Their argument was that this wouldn't be a almost as good return as normal investment, but in fact, you could make more money.
And he's pretty upfront about this. I mean, he flat out says, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, I wanted to make some money.
Oh, yes. And so there was a chapter of Al Gore's life right after his political career in 2000 where he felt as if, compared with other people in the Senate, he had never really made money. So for a couple of years, he did just that. He wanted to see if he could use the skills of asset management to advance something that would coincide with his environmental concerns, too. And so back in 2004, he and a man named David Blood, an American living in London, and a few other partners set up this firm that was designed to take what they called a holistic and sustainable approach to capitalism, whose results they're now announcing.
Obviously, you spent some time with Al Gore. You spent some time with David Blood. You were at their headquarters in London. You got to look at their list of investments. Numbers one and two are Microsoft and Qualcomm, which is nobody's idea of reinventing capitalism.
They have always said, we want to make a lot of money while also advancing these various goals. So they are looking for things which are good businesses, and in various ways they think that Microsoft and Qualcomm both are. I then looked at the rest of their list, and mm-hmm. I can tell you, I've looked at a lot of unusual companies over the years, and most of these I had simply never heard of.
Tell me about some of those unusual companies. There was a grocery distributor or something on that list, wasn't there?
Yes. Had you ever heard of a company called Ocado?
Never had, no.
I had not either, but it's a company that's based in the UK, and they contend that if you order groceries online for them and they deliver them to your house, the overall resource and carbon and every other environmental footprint of that is less than if you walked to the grocery store, let alone drive. Hmm. They don't have any stores, and they say that modern grocery stores are about the most environmentally inefficient things there are, because the freezer section is competing with the heating for the people, and it just is, and so much stuff spoils too and has to be distributed in trucks.
All right, so let's get the brass tacks here. How well is he doing? How well is Generation doing with this 10-year slice of their operations?
They are doing very well by the standards that capitalism should care about, which is return on assets. Over the last 10 years, which have been extremely tumultuous for the markets, as you very well know, the overall average global equity return in that time has been 7.0%. Mm-hmm. The average for all sort of serious, major, active management firms has been about 7.7% during that time, or just barely enough to cover the management costs. And during those same 10 years, Generation Investment Management has had returns of 12.1% per year. That is 500 basis points above the baseline, which your financially astute listeners will know is really something.
Yeah, but and our financially astute listeners will know what 500 basis points is, which is basically 5%.
Yes, exactly.
They are trying to change capitalism, but I'm obliged to point out here that they are a mere speck on the global capitalistic enterprise. They've got like, what, $12 billion under management?
Yes, they have $12 billion. You know, a lot to you and me, but it's about 1/400th of what BlackRock invests. So it is small, but Gore points out that small strategic investors have gotten people's attention when they say, again, we can make more money by going this way. And so I think that's why they're actually telling their story, saying that if others follow this direction, they think it would both make more money and be healthier for capitalism as a whole.
The latest in the Atlantic magazine is called The Planet-Saving, Capitalism-Subverting, Surprisingly Lucrative Investment Secrets of Al Gore by James Fallows. Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a combined nod to the Democratic debate tonight and the Twitter layoffs that brand new CEO Jack Dorsey announced this morning. Twitter, as you know, is trying desperately to find ways to make money. Ads, new things like that Moments tab, whatever the heck that is, pretty much anything. They also have been selling their trending topics, too. You pay and you get your issue in front of the entire Twitterverse. All of which gets me to Bernie Sanders and tonight's debate. Since Labor Day, CNN reports this afternoon, the senator from Vermont has had just 2 minutes of time on the nightly network news programs. 2 minutes, which is perhaps why a Twitter spokesperson told CNN today that Sanders is the first and so far the only candidate to buy a trending topic this cycle. Seems a little sad to me. Debate is at 8:30 Eastern, by the way. I sadly will miss it. I'm going to be on a plane. All right, you got to go. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.2% today, about 49 points. The NASDAQ off 0.8%, 42 points. The S&P 500 down 0.2%, 13 points. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kirwa. Thanks today to the staff here at KMUW in Wichita. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.